Hello again, and welcome to Talking Global Infrastructure. I'm Vlad Ben, Policy Research Manager at GIA. Joining me today is Andrew McHardy, Partner and Decarbonisation Hub Leader at KPMG. Thank you for joining, Andrew. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Vlad. It's a pleasure to join you today, and I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Great to have you, Andrew. Now, before we delve deeper, let's focus on the kind of intriguing and complex dynamics of COP28. Held in the United Arab Emirates, this year's summit presented a really fascinating juxtaposition. You know, a leading oil-producing nation hosting pivotal climate negotiations. This setting brought to the fore crucial questions about the commitment to the transition from fossil fuels and the broader implications for global energy policies. As part of our conversation today, we will discuss the risks that investors face in a rapidly changing climate landscape, where adapting investment strategies is becoming increasingly crucial for long-term sustainability and profitability. Equally important is the role of climate finance. The Loss and Damage Fund and the Global Stocktake, our progress report on achieving the goals of the Paris Agreement. As we navigate these themes, we'll explore the contentious issue of fossil fuel phase-out, you know, a topic which remains at the heart of climate action. Now, to start, Andrew, what is your sentiment on COP28? How did it go in your eyes, and do you see it as a success?
Well, thanks, Vlad. I mean, I think that that's a hotly debated issue or question at the moment. Plenty of reflections, having spent some time over in Dubai at COP28. And I think the measure of success will be determined in the year to come. As with previous COPs, it's all great what happens during the meetings and the agreements that are signed off. But what matters most is actions that are taken. So moving from those commitments beyond ambition and to action. So I think that's really what we're going to see over the coming year is how some of those agreements translate into tangible actions within the delegate nations.
Right. And considering the UAE's role as a significant fossil fuel exporter, do you believe this influenced the decisions and outcomes at COP28 at all, Andrew?
Well, I think it definitely set the scene for a conversation around fossil fuels, which is what we ended up with. There was a large representation from some of those fossil fuel industries and technology providers. So hosting this in the UAE definitely shone a spotlight on the fossil fuel discussion. And we certainly saw that in the end. I mean, that was the headline of COP28 at the end of the day was aligning on some text around the transitioning away from fossil fuels. And I think that was definitely a topic from the beginning of it. And as you point out, yeah, hosting this in the UAE just shone a spotlight on the need for that conversation and some of the commitments that went along with it. And we did see that, you know, going into overtime, but at least landing on some text that addressed oil and gas beyond coal, which had been discussed previously. Not quite a phase out or phase down as many had hoped for, but the word transitioning away definitely sets the course and an opening for that conversation to continue. Beyond that, though, you know, it extended really the conversation around the transformation of energy systems and the investment that's going to be needed to do that. Many countries pledging actions such as, you know, tripling renewables by 2030 alongside doubling energy efficiency along the same timeline. We saw conversations about technology that will aid in that transition. So things like carbon capture, utilization and storage for high emitting and hard to abate sectors. Also progress on the utilization of zero or low carbon fuels, such as hydrogen, and looking at, you know, some of the standards, the emission assessments, the criteria that will be needed to assess the progress and viability of some of those investments. I think a lot of that came together again under knowing that top of the agenda for this COP was to address, you know, the transition away from fossil fuels. And again, will continue to be debated in the year to come. But I think the overall sentiment is that at least we've moved the yardsticks on the conversation, and now is the opportunity to continue that forward.
Great. Thank you, Andrew. And, you know, touching on some of those pledges that we made, the, you know, 3x renewables, focus on new technologies to aid to that decarbonization path. So climate change poses pretty significant risks, and the consequences of inaction are becoming more and more apparent. what strategy should investors adopt to navigate this landscape, and how can they effectively balance risk and return?
Thanks for that, Vlad. Just stepping back from COP28 and some of the overall conversations, it certainly reinforced the critical role that institutional investors will play in that transition to a low carbon economy. We recognize the massive deployment of capital that will be required to decarbonize energy systems, industries, and infrastructure. At the same time, though, as concerns are raised about the trajectory of global warming and, you know, 2023 looking to be the hottest year on record, it is consideration for, you know, how those investments will balance investment in mitigation alongside the adaptation to some of the physical and transition risks. So I would say that, you know, perspectives are evolving on how to evaluate risk and returns associated with these climate investments. Often we're looking at, when we're talking infrastructure, these are long life assets. And if you think about the life of the asset, there will be significant challenges continuing within the physical environment, but also within the various economies and markets where those infrastructure assets are located. So I think from an investor point of view, it really is a increasing complexity of evaluating those risks and returns and thinking about how to quantify the social environmental impact associated with those, which again can be a form of value creation and helping to sort of manage some of the risks that may be associated with some of those infrastructure developments. I'd say that in conversations that there's a good understanding of what are green assets and, you know, things that are more straightforward, such as certain renewables. But those transition assets or the transition investments, there's a, you know, much higher degree of uncertainty. So that's where I think the challenge comes in assessing risk versus return and looking at, you know, what is that pipeline of investable projects and solutions that can be built and scaled.
Given the significant emphasis on resilience, mitigation, and adaptation, both in the lead up to and during COP28, how should investors strategically align their portfolios to effectively contribute to these critical areas?
I think, you know, investors really need to think about the balance between mitigation and adaptation, recognizing, you know, what are some of the constraints from a technical, financial, legal, regulatory, and market perspective. And that certainly comes into play. Where a lot of investors are spending time is really looking at their current portfolios, trying to categorize those risks, you know, the likelihood of being able to achieve decarbonization targets, what is actually achievable or feasible in terms of both decarbonizing and building resilience. And what that really comes down to is the credibility of the transition plans for some of those assets and corporates that are involved. So thinking about, you know, the robustness of those transition plans, which are much more than just targets. They're actually well thought out, analyzed options to be able to move those infrastructure assets forward. And within those transition plans, the different scenarios, prioritize actions, contingencies, and considerations of emerging risks. So I think that is it really, when investors are sort of looking at their current portfolios and future investments, a key piece of that is being able to assess the credibility and achievability of the transition plans that are in place or will need to be in place.
Thank you, Andrew. And in terms of our path to that sustainable future, and, you know, the roles of Indigenous communities and smaller island states are often highlighted. Can you shed some light on how they were involved at COP28 and what kind of role they can play in de-risking some of these investments?
Well, I recall, you know, day one walking onto the COP28 site and into the Blue Zone, and it was really incredible to see the visible presence of Indigenous communities coming from across the globe, gathering to share their knowledge, their experiences, and goals from their communities' perspectives. Certainly, Indigenous communities have and will continue to play a critical role, beginning with being active participants in the process of defining the actions that will need to be taken. It's hard to think of any of these major energy transition projects that need to be developed, it would not benefit and absolutely require consultation with Indigenous communities, and beyond consultation, really active participation, looking at the use of land, water, other ecosystem factors that will be very important in determining success. And of course, leveraging Indigenous knowledge related to resilience, adaptation, nature, biodiversity. It was, I think, very, very validating, very important to see those Indigenous communities very active in COP28. And, obviously, a very critical role in helping to move those actions forward.
Right. It's certainly interesting to see how that will develop. Now, you touched on a few themes leading up to COP28. We had the global stocktake, adaptation and resilience. And one other central theme was climate finance, especially around the proposals of the Loss and Damage Fund. Could you provide some insight into these developments and elaborate on how they're expected to influence the landscape?
Certainly, Vlad. As you point out, alongside accelerating the energy transition, climate finance was a major focus area leading up to 28, and certainly drove a lot of the conversations. What we've seen is investments in climate have increased. We're looking at standing around $1.3 trillion annually, which is more than double where we were in 2019, 2020. A lot of that focused on mitigation, as we mentioned earlier in the conversation. We're seeing that more of a shift or more of a focus on adaptation to go alongside mitigation, and both need to accelerate. Mentioned around the massive deployment of capital that will be required to transform our energy systems. Estimates around $4 plus trillion per year until 2030, and even beyond that, $5 trillion. Or per year up to 2050. Higher estimates look to be more in the 8 to 10 trillion every year to 2050. So what that says is there's a lot to learn, a lot of unknowns there. But the bottom line is that that significant increase in climate finance is required to be able to achieve the targets that are in front of us. You mentioned, Vlad, the loss and damage, and certainly was a key feature of COP28, agreement on approximately $700 million in support for countries and communities that are most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. This fund will be managed by the World Bank going forward, and it supports activities like national response planning, which includes monitoring and alerts for extreme weather events, but as well support for temporary or permanent relocation or migration of communities. So that was an important step forward in seeing the establishment of the Loss and Damage Fund. And certainly, investment will continue there. And then beyond that, just other big headlines at COP28, the Global Climate Fund deploying $30 billion to look to attract in the order of $250 billion in private investment. The Green Climate Fund, an additional pledge of a little over $3 billion from some additional six countries. And so now we're in the range of almost $13 billion in the Green Climate Fund. And then just talking a little bit about adaptation finance. On the positives, there is sort of a new framework that's being looked at. There certainly needs to be more discussion and sort of firm targets set, but definitely a positive trend right now.
Certainly sounds positive. And the Loss and Damage Fund is a legacy of COP27, which has seen a good amount of progress to address the kind of urgent needs of the most vulnerable, while fostering a spirit of that cooperation between states, private sector bodies and the public. And I think it's worthwhile mentioning as well the positive steps that blended financing has taken at COP. We saw $5 billion announced at the Business and Philanthropy Forum. For private investors, this means they have more opportunities to partner with public funds, again, reducing risks and increasing the potential impacts of their investments. You touched on the $30 billion Climate Solutions Fund. There was also a creation of a think tank for global climate financing, a collaboration between the World Bank, HSBC and BlackRock, among six others. I think before we finish, were there any notable omissions from the discussions at COP28? And I'll have to ask, what do you think of our next hosts, Azerbaijan?
There's a lot of work ahead of us, Vlad. I think that's just the nature of climate action. Is it really matters what happens after the meeting, then in addition to what's discussed during the convention. One thing we didn't mention in this conversation so far, and a real positive, was the focus, I think, on nature as part of that, the climate action plans. And we saw things like, a 2030 deforestation target being set. So that's very, very positive in that alignment between climate mitigation, adaptation, and nature positive actions, as well as just the conversation around people, lives, livelihoods, really focusing on some aspects of gender equality, the just transition, nature as part of the climate discussion. And those are things that will certainly carry forward to Azerbaijan. I think beyond that, the landmark text on transition away from fossil fuels, there is more work to be done there to define those requirements, clarify the phase out of some of the fossil fuel subsidies, looking a little more carefully at what was introduced as transitional fuels. So there's work there to be done. Again, not an omission. I would just say that is additional conversation that will need to happen at during Azerbaijan. We talked about adaptation financing. Again, a lot more conversation to come and really defining those funding targets for adaptation. And maybe the one last thing I'll mention is around carbon markets. But unfortunately, not full agreement on some of the Article 6 provisions. And functioning carbon markets is seen as a key to success in climate action. And these are the systems that will be established to buy and sell carbon credits as a means of facilitating climate actions and financing for emission reduction projects. So, there's work to be done there, though we didn't reach agreement on some of those provisions, some of the need for standards and structures to supervise carbon markets in order to overcome some of the credibility issues that have been encountered to date. But that is definitely going to be something I think that will carry forward to Azerbaijan. And hopefully we get to a point where we have agreement on some of those standards and supervision for carbon markets.
Thanks very much, Andrew. I think COP28 has been a success. Has it been a success? I think it's up to debate for some. Prior to it, there was an increase in global collaboration, and I think that's been the most important outcome, is that renewed collaboration. We saw the US and China kind of agree on new renewables. Cooperation between the two largest parties and Nairobi Declaration at the Africa Climate Summit in September as well, with African leaders targeting 300 gigawatts of renewable energy. And I think if we can have more collaboration at COP29, then it'll definitely be a success. Now, that brings us to the end of our episode, unless you have any other further thoughts, Andrew.
Maybe just to circle back on what was your first question around, success and what does success look like? I think you just mentioned collaboration, partnerships. Those things are so key to moving forward with climate action. We had over 80,000 delegates at COP28. Again, that's a hotly discussed issue, and whether that added value or not, but I would take a positive away from that what we're seeing is real engagement and real positive engagement from across policymakers, NGOs, industry, investors, all other climate stakeholders, in sort of coming together and taking meaningful action towards climate. So, I think there's a lot of positives to take from COP28. There's a lot of work ahead of us, but I'd prefer to focus on some of those positive outcomes and build on that. So again, thanks, Vlad. Really appreciated the opportunity to talk about COP today, and great to join you.
A good note to end on. Thank you very much, Andrew. Thank you to our listeners for joining us for this episode of Talking Global Infrastructure. Please be sure to subscribe to us on Spotify and iTunes, and follow us on LinkedIn as well. Thank you for listening for this year. We look forward to speaking with you in 2024.